Welcome to the C Word, the Conservatives podcast. Today we're talking about condition lost. I'm Jenna Mathiason, an Objects Conservative based in Carmarthen in Wales.
I'm Chloe Rumsey, an Objects Conservative based in Manchester in England.
I'm Liz Hebert, a Paintings Conservator based in Amsterdam.
I'm Federica Madrimo, a Conservator of Antiquities based in Nicosia, Cyprus.
Look at us being all professional.
We're so professional. Hello, episode two.
It's nice to see you all again. I know that listeners can't actually see us, but I just like hanging out with these guys. So
we're super happy to see each other.
Yeah, so, it's basically an adorable friendship.
Tough luck, guys.
Always.
Okay, so today is a broad topic, but I thought it might be a really fun one to talk about and explore. So, you know, buckle up, listeners. I hope you like a philosophical one where we're going to ramble a bit, because this is definitely one.
It's been on the list for a while, though.
It has.
On the magic list.
I think it's because it's sort of like, it sort of sparks my imagination a bit. It's like, condition lost. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Yeah.
There's so many different meanings.
I know.
So I'm super interested, because when we were talking about this, I was like, I have like one idea, and it's the most straightforward one. It's like you go to the place where your database says your object is, and it isn't there.
Oh, I see.
That's what I, and then I was thinking of all the different reasons it could be not there.
I mean, that's a good starting point. Has that happened to anyone else? Has anyone else?
All the time.
Oh. Yeah.
The immediate reaction was beautiful. Yes.
We end up finding them in the end.
Yeah, yes. That's the important bit. That's important. Yeah, that's really good. That's good.
The lost aspect of it is only for a few.
Yeah, yeah. But lost can be misplaced, for example. So that makes sense to me. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like something might not be where you expect it to be. That's a fun game when you're looking for something, whether it's for an exhibition or for treatment or for an audit. And it's like, oh, look, that's not in that box.
Where is it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just a matter of spacing when you try and find it on the catalog. So there's a space or a dot or a dash that you forget, and or you don't know it's there. And then you're searching everywhere in storage rooms. Until you figure out, oh no.
Or someone's done a typo where it's like, oh, it's not shelf A, it's shelf, it's shelf S, or
yeah,
whatever it is.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm.
So I can understand how that would feel like loss in the moment. But for me, that definition is more about dissociation.
Which is, of course, an agent of deterioration. So yeah, that's a good one.
One of the 10.
Yeah, exactly. One of the 10.
But it's so common, and it's such an issue, especially I've worked in a lot of smaller collections, like local collections as well. And if there isn't some kind of, you know, database setup already established, then every few years somebody comes in with a new idea and the database gets redone.
Oh boy.
And then it just is a kind of struggle.
And then it's just like three Excel spreadsheets that no one's ever looked at because no one knew that the other one existed, and suddenly it's really messy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. It's also I think the number of people who have access to those is also a factor, because they might get overwhelmed or underwhelmed by the amount of information, wanting to add more or wanting to simplify it. But in the end, it's not simplified at all.
And that's why a central database is beautiful, but only if you have access to it, which then might be another problem. Because I don't know if you guys have come across this, but sometimes like there'll be like limited licenses for who can access the database, for example.
Yeah.
And then it's a nightmare trying to find a person with the right license or getting that transferred from an old laptop to a new laptop or whatever it is. This is the most archaic system ever, guys. This is not okay.
Museums.
And this is something that we've known about for quite some time. In the 80s, they established a Council for the Documentation of the Lost Art and Cultural Heritage.
Cool.
And I believe it was an EU program that was intended to really document lost art so that at least we have the memory remaining of it, right?
Cool.
But This was the 80s, and computers were fairly new. And within 2 decades, when they went back to check things, almost all of the files that they had archived had been corrupted in some way.
Oh, no.
Or technology
was no longer accessible. So not only was the original art lost, but also the information about the art was lost as well.
Oh, that sucks, man.
No.
Crazy, right?
Data management is important, people.
Yeah.
So important. Yeah. I mean, I hope that we've learned from that a little bit, at least, in terms of, well, I do feel like when I hear people talk about data these days, I feel like people do think a lot about, let's make sure that it's in a format that can still be read 10 years from now. And I feel like people are talking about that. So maybe there's been some learning from that sort of mistake. But equally, it could just be that we talk to more like information scientists and data people now who go, have you thought about this? And everyone goes, what do you mean a Word document isn't good enough?
See, I think that I come back to a very archaic preference here, because that's sort of that every so often happens in my institution. And I'm talking about there's a bunch of condition records, essentially, by a bunch of
you're not going to be an index card girl, are you? You're not going to go back
boy.
To the index cards.
Oh,
are
baby.
You
wait. You wait.
Oh, my God.
So that my institution has been through this sort of, they bought the computers in, and then everyone knew how to use the computers, and they transferred all of the documents onto the computers, and it was all digitized, and they had somebody doing all the typing up for them. You know, like early 90s stuff.
Okay.
Low funding, all of the things you can imagine. And now we've had these various server changes and all of the stuff, and every so often I'm finding that I just cannot open one of the condition reports.
Oh, no.
Cannot open it.
That's not great.
Tom can fix it. I can't remember any of the details. He's explained it to me several times. He can fix it because he's techie Tom and he does things, but I can't do it at work. I have to send him the file.
Not ideal from a data point of view.
No, exactly.
It means that every institution needs a techie Tom, which is really what we should be doing.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. But I'm not stressed about this because all of the original documents are printed out.
Printed out? Wow.
But they've been built up over the decades.
Okay,
so we still keep that very same system of having paper files. And
you should ideally keep a hard copy of anything you have
really
digitally.
Beautiful. Yeah, sure. We've got really beautiful folders labeled 1 to 500. And they're all there. And they've all got their, pasted in 90s photo.
Aww.
But barring fire, God, touch wood, that never happens. We're just not going to lose the information.
Does the information start from the first day of the opening of your institution? Or do you have the first few years of it as well?
Yes. So from the, we're extremely lucky, I have to say, we're extremely lucky that when the museum started, before the museum started, a bunch of the collection, the starting point of the collection was just thrust at a conservator. And then that individual continued to work at the museum for 26 years.
Wow.
And then it was handed down to my boss and subsequently to me as well. So that is so rare, and it takes away what Liz was talking about with the constant changing hands of people who don't really understand it.
Very rare to have people that have been there for so long and understand the system.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, by contrast to your institution, Chloe, Fedra's is just opening. And do you know anything about how they're doing their documentation, or not their documentation, but the organization?
Well, no, the new building is opening, but the museum, the concept of the museum, has been around since the 1920s.
Gotcha. Oh!
So we have a museum since the 1920s, and we definitely do not have all of the records. It's difficult. I mean, we went through an independence from the British because the institution was opened by the British in the 1920s. So in the 1960s, we gained independence, and therefore there was a whole political hoopla, let's just say. And then 1974, we had a illegal invasion of the island. So during that year, artifacts were all packed and sent to Athens, and they came back 9 years later.
Wow.
There's a lot of, loss in terms of documents.
Yeah.
But we do what we can to find as much information as we can for objects. Thankfully, since the 70s, definitely since the 90s, we have everything.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Both of you have mentioned the 90s. Was the 90s some like time of everybody getting their shit together in terms of
a little bit,
documentation,
yeah. A little bit. Archives?
Heightened global wealth before various crashes.
Yeah, and then,
occurred,
you know, yes, and I suppose it was also the sort of era of people learning about computers and figuring out how that works. So, yeah, interesting. I sort of want to do a deep dive into that side of things at some point, but yeah. I'm really interested in it from a really nerdy perspective.
Yes.
Like, what was the early museum computer world like? I would love to know that.
Can I leap back to the idea of finding a location on a database and then going to a box in the store and finding
we can go back to
the
depressing box, yes.
So I feel like, though obviously you've got more potential of either mishandled information or just lost information because of multi-handling in smaller institutions, I feel like if you're the British Museum or somewhere vast, if that happens, you're sort of more screwed. Because where are you going to look? If the information is just wrong and the box is just empty, what are you going to do about it? Like, at least if you've got a small room, you can look. You can check, like, look at every single object label in that small room. Not at the British Museum, you can't. What are you going to do? I'm sort of horrified by that idea.
You just got to wait till it turns up.
Did you listen to the podcast from the BBC about the theft at the British Museum?
I was going to bring up theft as a thing.
This is ridiculous.
You have to. It's very nicely done, kind of like a true crime.
Oh, very nice.
Scenario. It's very captivating.
So send us a link and we'll put it in the show notes,
please,
for people to listen to, because that sounds lovely.
Oh, it's amazing. But about condition loss, there was the theft back in 2022. They figured it out.
Technically, they'd been told about it in 2021, but they didn't believe the person who told them.
Yeah. So there was a theft and destruction of precious stones and Roman and ancient Greek artifacts that were then sold on eBay.
Oh, man.
But they are talking about British museums and the British Museum and how multiple shelves of each holding about 200 gemstones were completely empty, were found to be completely empty or smashed.
Why? Oh, there are multiple levels of loss there.
These things happen to the biggest and most known museums, where you wouldn't think that something like that would happen. So
when it started becoming publicly known that there'd been thefts from the British Museum, I really feel like people were like, wow, people can steal from museums. And it's like, obviously. But people really did think only of heists up until that point, right? When it's a big, where someone comes in and cuts out a painting and it's part of some sort of film or it's like a, you know, they really thought of just heists. And I'm like, you're really missing out on the really mundane angle of someone just put something in their pocket and walked out because no one checks.
It happens all the time.
Can I also just float in with the mental image of someone doing a proper like balaclava heist and they go in there about to break the lock in the behind the scenes, you know, staff area, and they just find that the MagSafe lock is broken. So they get in and then they find their blueprints and they sneak off to the collections room and they get their lock picking or whatever, I've played too much Assassin's Creed stuff, and then they just find that someone's left the key in the door.
Oh yeah.
You know, like
absolutely. 1,000%. Or then, Chloe, surely the natural point here is then they open the box and it's not there anyway.
Yes.
Because no one put it back.
Exactly.
But yeah, up until that point, I really feel like people were thinking of like big heist things and not at all really about sort of the petty theft that it would in theory be super, super easy. And then people started actually talking about how easy it would be and how much it will happen because when and whether people notice or not, because until there's the next collections audit, no one might notice that something is missing. And at that point, you don't know why it's missing. You know, was it sent off to be repaired somewhere? No one did the paperwork, which, by the way, happens.
It's on a 20-year loan somewhere.
or it's with some poor conservator somewhere who's, you know, been working on it for 5 years. And then someone's like, oh, we just thought that was purely gone. We just thought someone had stolen that. And it's like, no, you're supposed to be paying me for this now. You know, like, crazy things happen, right?
Yeah.
What we're describing now actually is one of the points that I wanted to make about loss. What does the loss of an artwork add to its value? And the concept of stolen art coming back is not new. Most famously is the Mona Lisa.
The Mona Lisa was stolen?
The what? Really?
Yes.
The Mona Lisa is largely as famous as it is because it was stolen.
No.
It was always a masterpiece by Leonardo da Vinci, but it was in the Louvre in 1911, and it got stolen, and it was a huge international story. And because of the amount of press surrounding the theft of the Mona Lisa, you know, it got a little bit sexy because Picasso was involved, and El Gournier, like there were artists of the time of the Paris set who were part of this like conspiracy ring of thieves. It got very sensationalized, right? It did show up a few years later in Italy by the guy who had stolen it, who was just somebody who had been contracted to do a little bit of construction at the Louvre. Walking through one day, saw nobody had their eye on it, took it.
Amazing.
So it really can be just that simple in 1912 and in 2021.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That's wild. I didn't actually know that bit of backstory. That's fantastic. You do often see, you know, interesting headlines about like, oh, my God, missing artwork found and things like that. Like it gets very sensational. Nobody says that if it's, you know, I'm trying to think of the least sexy thing I can think of. No one says that if it's a bit of
a farmhold hammer, one of 2,000.
Yeah. No one would steal a plow. I'm just trying to think of the least sexy thing that someone would actually steal. I'm not really sure what I can think of.
Gemstones were mentioned, painting.
Yeah, they're really sexy things, aren't they? Yeah. As where if someone like takes a teapot because they think it's really nice, chances are that's just not going to be noticed as much.
Yeah. A set of clogs.
I think it depends. It depends on the reason why it was stolen. So, in terms of 1974 in Cyprus, a lot of artifacts were stolen from what is now the occupied side of Cyprus and sold all around the world. And the Department of Antiquities and Cypriots are really trying to find a way to return these artifacts back, and whether it is a unique ceramic or if it's a tiny, I don't know, a perfume bottle that we have thousands of already, we attach the same importance and the same value to them because we just want as many of those artifacts back into Cypriot soil. A lot of wall paintings as well from churches or mosaics, even though those artifacts will never go back, or not never, I don't know, we'll never know. I guess we'll have to see in the next few decades. But as for now, even if they're returned into Cypriot soil, they will not be returned into their original context, which is now the occupied part.
But there, the ownership is the important thing, I suppose, that it's for the Cypriot people. So that makes sense to me.
It is. Exactly. But it was kind of funny because the department this year has acquired a lot of its artifacts back, and they made social media posts about it. And, you know, we're all happy about it. And it's really fantastic. There's this huge case that took 13 years with a art dealer called Dickman, in Germany. Anyways, the last, I think, 50 artifacts were returned in July, if I remember correctly. In any case, in the photograph, you had like this tiny little perfume bottle, which, again, there are thousands of already, which are practically the same. But it was significant because of the story behind the theft, rather than the object itself. So yes, as Liz said, some artifacts gain more value and importance due to the story behind the theft itself.
Yeah, because exactly, it's part of the story. It's part of the provenance as well. And in terms of like value and how the art market works, which is not, it's like my least favorite thing about art, it does have a contribution and have a monetary effect, which is interesting, disgusting, interesting.
Disgusting. It depends how you feel about capitalism, I guess.
Yeah.
So I have a pretty disgusting story about capitalism.
Oh, no.
Go on.
Is this going to really enforce my opinion of paintings conservators as like the conservation celebrities? Oh, yeah, that Vermeer. Whatevs.
It doesn't have anything to do with conservation. Although I did think that I didn't explore this, but I did think that, like, what is the avenue between lost and conservation? Like, the loss in a painting, but that's not what I'm getting into.
Ooh, okay, okay, okay. We'll put a pin in that.
We're talking about capitalism here. So the way that the uber rich interact with art is very different from how we do. They view it more as investment. Maybe there's an aesthetic component for them, a personal connection, but mostly it's to save their money and get out of taxes. And Switzerland famously is a great tax haven, and they actually have something set up specifically for art. They're called Freeports. And essentially what these are is, it's in Geneva. They're these large warehouses that are all climate controlled, absolutely perfect from a conservation, like scientific perspective. But what the rich can do is they put their art, it can be any art, but for my sake, we'll talk paintings. They put their paintings into the Freeport, and it essentially functions as, it doesn't have any country that it's associated with. So if they want to sell their art to somebody else who has an account in the Freeport, they can exchange their money without any tax, and the art never leaves the wall, but the ownership changes. So although this is art that isn't lost,
is this like
traditional sense,
rich people Pokemon cards?
Yes. Oh my God, that's such a good way of saying it.
That happens with artifacts as well in those Freeports. They do leave those artifacts within those Freeports for decades until it's kind of forgotten. The paperwork has changed from one ownership to the other, and so nobody can trace it. And then that's the perfect opportunity to then bring it and to another country and sell it, you know, because it might be very, very difficult to trace its origins back. So this happens all the time in the artifact world as well. It's really disgusting, as you said.
Yeah, I didn't go deep on the fact checking, but I did see one figure that said the oldest Freeport in Switzerland started in 1888.
Woohoo! What?
Wow. Yeah. That's wild. That really is a different world, isn't it?
History of the super rich. In the extremely unlikely event that one of these people is listening to this episode, you should be ashamed of yourself.
Hire me.
Give the money to us.
Liz is a very talented paintings conservator. She has just doubled her rate.
That's fascinating. I did not know about that. That's super fascinating. It also raises some interesting questions in terms of, like, say that someone who then comes into ownership of one of these pieces of art actually wants to give that to a museum, might actually be really problematic, because if you can't prove where it came from, or if that's in any way unclear, most museums can't touch that now, because that means that even if it's a donation or something, that if it has unclear provenance, you know, it could have been stolen at some point. So that would make that very difficult, which I think is super interesting. That sort of makes these things untouchable, like in terms of they can't necessarily enter the public sphere again in a sort of different way.
I don't know, because you can forge a paper and make it look super formal. And
Fedra, we're legit, not going to endorse that.
I'm definitely not endorsing it.
Fedra, it's funny, our brains went in completely different directions. You thought about forgery, and I thought, well, the rich care about their money more than anything, and they document that pretty well. So at least we have those
references. Fair point, yeah.
Well, there are multiple problems here, multiple.
Heritage for the people, guys. All property is theft. All property is theft.
I like this angle. This is great because this wasn't something I'd thought of, but actually you could consider private ownership to sort of be lost to people, because actually it's only seen by the person who owns it, if they even care and look at it. You know, like assuming that eccentric rich people actually have these up on the wall as opposed to have them in a freeport or in a warehouse or in a vault or in their doomsday bunker or whatever it is they're doing.
Or behind their gypsum walls.
Yes.
Trying to hide them.
Yeah, or under the floor or in space. I don't know what they're doing this week. But, you know, but it's lost to people because we can't access that. Like, you know, we might have photos of it. We might know a thing or two about it, but we don't, like, have access to it in that way. Yeah, that's not an angle I'd considered in this episode. That was great. Yeah, that's a different kind of condition lost, isn't it?
Can I ask a super boring question about insurance?
Oh god.
I'll try.
Is how expensive is it to keep these things in, like, the freeports? Yes, I'm guessing that's all sorted out by
presumably a yearly fee.
Butlers, yeah. Or but if you've got something like a Picasso on your wall, how expensive is that insurance? And is it actually just cheaper to loan it to a museum than have that in your house?
I can't speak to if it's cheaper insurance versus loaning it out to a museum. But depending on the country, I know the laws for the UK actually better than any. There are a lot of tax incentives for you sharing your art and making it publicly available, either through a loan to a museum, a full donation, or just like access to it in some way, and tax benefits that then make it so that you don't have to pay as much tax on the art, I believe.
I'm extremely divided on that topic. Very, very mixed.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is still a scheme that's going, but I've been spending a lot of time on a website called Art UK, which is a
love
brilliant
website.
Brilliant database of art in museums in the UK. In a lot of them, you'll see it'll say something about the acquisition method, for example, if it was a donation or if it was bought, that sort of thing. But sometimes it will say things like donation in lieu. And usually that means that it was a tax dodge or not quite a tax dodge. That's the wrong word. It might be a historic debt, if you see what I mean. So a family that used to be wealthy is suddenly bankrupt. And instead of having to sell off all of the nice manor houses they have, they can offset this by, rather than paying loads of taxes, actually give the art to the public, for example. So it's a great way for museums to acquire art, and instead it becomes this sort of tax write-off type thing. On the other hand, tax is lovely because it pays for things like the NHS and schools. So I kind of rather have the money in some ways, but the art is also really nice. But yeah, it is interesting. And I don't know if this is still ongoing or if this is just a historic thing that's been done. That I can't speak to, but it is interesting seeing that sort of thing in databases.
I love where this went, by the way. It's fantastic.
What, the anti-capitalist rant in the middle of the
yes!
episode?
Well, we all know from last season how much I love house museums, and we are talking about the rich. I was recently on a trip in the U.S., and I went to one house museum while I was there outside of D.C. It's Marjorie Post's house. Is anyone familiar with Marjorie Post?
No.
No, she was born in the late 1800s, and her father was the guy who, like, started General Mills.
Oh, geez. Okay, yeah.
So uber, uber wealthy, and kind of like the last of that type of wealth. We still obviously have super wealthy people, but this was still like settled in these old world values. And the two things that she really loved to collect and that are in her house museum a lot are, I believe, 18th century French art and then like monarchy grand Russian art as well. And the reason she has so much Russian art is because her husband was an ambassador to Russia after the fall of the monarchy, right?
Yeah.
And there was a placard that was on the wall and it said something along the lines of like, Marjorie Post was living in Russia after the fall of the monarchy when art was being redistributed. And I turned to my friend and I said, that's a funny way to say what happens during the downfall of every war, which is that art gets looted and stolen and tossed about.
Redistributed is a very sweet way of putting that. Yeah.
Yeah. Taken away from the Russian people, basically.
And I think so much art is lost to war.
So much. Mm, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that ties in nicely with one of our previous episodes, which we'll also point people to in the show notes, about conflict. And yeah, it's crazy to think like things are lost in terms of permanently lost because they've been destroyed, but also lost in terms of being looted, and sold and illegally distributed.
Maliciously taken away. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's a lot and it happens an awful lot just all over the world all the time.
Yeah. It's also tragic because a lot of these conflicts are getting older and older now, and that generation of people who lived it and who had the remainder of all these objects that they could save for themselves and that they've carried for decades in their pockets, now these people are dying as well. So all this information, all these objects will be lost with them.
Back to dissociation.
Back to dissociation, yes. I mean, for me, I am half Pontic. And the Pontic people suffered a genocide between 1914 and 1923. And then they were forced out of their houses and not being able to take any of their objects with them. So the physical culture, their physical culture was gone. Their physical heritage was gone. They had to adapt and move to new countries. And so they really held on their more intangible heritage. So their language and their music. And unfortunately, the language now, it's been three generations and I don't speak the dialect of Pontic, nor do my cousins, which is terrible. We should probably learn it. I have to buy a dictionary somewhere. If somebody knows of a Pontic dictionary, please point me to it. So nowadays, apart from the music, really, the Pontic culture is dying. Any trace of heritage from that group of people is dying. And I know that this is happening with so many cultures that suffered through war and through conflicts over, let's say, 80 years ago.
Yeah, it's a very different world now, because I'm remembering back to when we talked about saving Ukrainian heritage digitally. That now, because people were saving the websites and the catalogues of museums so that there would be a record of those kept. And of course, that's only possible now because of where technology is at. And in the past, that sort of thing wasn't possible. That any information that was put in a bonfire was lost, and anything that got burnt and taken away, that is lost. It's loss looks very different now in some ways than it did then. And the generational impact of that is massive. Not to be a downer, but aside from war and conflict, which are a big deal, we've also got, you know, natural disasters and climate change coming up that will lead to further loss in general of cultural heritage and people's personal heritage. You know, that's going to be huge coming up. And we're going to have to think of some ways of tackling that, whether that is recording oral histories or saving people's photos or whatever it is that we're going to do. We're going to have to figure out some strategies here, people, because this is coming up fast and it's probably going to be bigger than we think. Climate refugees are already a thing, and it's just going to keep on happening. And yeah, so it's going to be a bit traumatic because, yeah, it's coming up and it's coming up everywhere. It's not really a thing to sort of think only parts of the world are going to be affected by this, because actually it's actually going to happen everywhere, just to different degrees. And yeah, that's something to think about, mull over. Everyone gets homework. Everyone who listens to this gets homework now. Think about what we're going to do. What are we going to do about those things? And minimize those losses or find ways around them, because sometimes you just, some things will be lost. That's just how it is. But we know that from material culture as well. You know, like, we can't save every kind of material. We know that from plastics and things like that. Like, it's a constant battle, and sometimes you just know you can't win them.
On the topic of salvage, I've just done that list for work, or participated in it. And we've gone over the, this is, you know, take a video of this is how you get this out of this case sort of thing. And on a number of occasions now, it's been, and we're just going to open this case. Oh, it doesn't open far enough. Oh, what's going on here? And then, why is this not working? And why is that not working? And we've just, you know, when you're lying on the floor of the gallery in closing time, trying to work out why the case isn't working, or trying to work out why the object won't fit out of the case because you have to dismantle the case. Somebody pipes up, I'm glad the building's not burning down. Like, thank you! Obviously.
Yeah.
This is why we do trial evacuations, guys.
True that. This brings to mind two things. One is sort of, it's quite personal loss. Like, have we lost something that we care about? Because, like, I've never had a traumatic fire or anything like that. Thank God for that. If you have, I'm really sorry. But I've certainly discovered things that I care about that have been at a point of loss, if you see what I mean. Like, recently, it was a year ago at this point, a little less, but around a year ago, I went through some of my childhood stuff in my parents' attic because they really want me to get my crap out of their house, and that's fair. I've not lived there for nearly 20 years. They should be cranky with me. Anyway, I went through a bunch of stuff, and a lot of it went to charity, and a depressing amount still went to landfill or recycling because of the state the plastics were in, for example. It was often plastics. So just things had decayed badly. I mean, what do you expect? Things are not actually meant to last forever in some ways. And, you know, children's toys of the late 80s to early 90s, mixed bag in terms of quality, guys. not to mention safety. There were things in everything that we shouldn't be having in anyone's toys. But yeah, so that was interesting to me because that was a sad time, like parting with those things and seeing them very much not like how I remember them at all, but, you know, melted goo or falling apart or heavily discolored or something, you know, where it's just like, this is not how I remember this at all. That's just sad. But that's, you know, again, a type of loss that I can see in collections, you know, where something's just too far gone. But there, I don't have the emotional trauma of like, this is something that I loved and treasured, and it's a real shame that it's gone. You do get a bit more clinical in a collection, because it's not your personal thing. You have that distance. Even if you have maybe had something similar, then there's still that distance, because you can be a bit more professional about it, I think, and just be like, that is a shame, but we're just going to have to say that, that item is gone. That object no longer exists, or that's going to have to be disposed of sensibly because something's just too far gone. Often modern materials, but it can depend.
So I think I don't know if this is the conservation coming out or just a sort of slightly neurodivergent distress. If I find something in my house that, anything that has suffered custodial neglect, basically.
Nice way of putting it.
If I find something like, oh, it was tucked behind the curtain and now it's, you know, it was winter and it's either completely faded or completely covered in mold, depending on, you know, you know, various damp proofing situations. I know, moth as well. Anything that has been accidentally neglected for a period of time and has become damaged as a result of that. I find that very distressing in general, and I do my best to avoid that sort of thing. Mm. And that sort of, I found that it doesn't really, it sort of doesn't change depending on how important the object is, because I always have this, I should have known better kind of feeling towards it.
But I get
something
you.
An object that isn't in my possession, or was never in my possession really, but I keep coming back to in my mind as a point of real regret, is my dad, both my parents are artists, my dad did a painting and was working on a painting for 20 years. And it's sort of this family story of, you know, the eccentric artists working and working and reworking and going over this drawing of this painting. And he works in charcoal normally. So it was, you know, it's a particular thing that he was painting this. And I, throughout my life, I've got the charcoal version of this painting. And throughout my life, I always thought that it was just rolled up in their attic. And 2 years ago, I found out that it is not, because 10 years ago, he set fire to it in the garden.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
And it no longer exists.
Well, I suppose that's the artist's choice.
Exactly. I'm furious with the artist.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's really like...
That's a ride. Yeah.
I really regret that. I really regret it.
You know, we're talking about loss, but I think the conversation has kind of transformed into talking about longevity in some ways.
Yeah.
And I am often asked when I tell people out in the art world that I'm a paintings conservator, and painters will ask me, what are the materials that I can use in order to have my art last as long as possible?
Yeah.
And to be quite honest, I can't answer this question because I don't work with contemporary art. So I do have that as a gimme. But in addition to that, I always tell them that as the conservator, it's not my job to affect the artistic process. It's whatever you decide to do, however you decide to create it. From that point on, once it's out of your hands and into mine, that's when my job starts.
That's a beautiful answer. Mm-hmm. My answer is very different because my mother asks, she does a sort of composite material sculpture. And she says, right, what can I use to achieve this that won't deteriorate? And I go, these things will give you your best shot. And she goes, so I can't use this. No, Mum, you probably shouldn't use that. I mean, yeah, it'd be all right, but you probably, like, this would be better. Okay, well, I've already done it. Do you think it'll be all right? Like,
oh, that's beautiful.
So she doesn't listen to a word I say.
You artists wouldn't.
Exactly.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's so interesting. No, I love that. I think that there's something to be said about giving people information about... if they want the information, I think it should be available in terms of often we don't know. But, you know, when we do know, when we do have data, when we've done aging, like artificial aging and things like that, if we do have that data, it's nice if it's out there and available, preferably in a way that people can actually understand without being an actual material scientist.
Bingo.
But yeah, I don't think it's necessarily up to us to tell people as such of like, never use this or always use this, because so many different things play a role here. But informed choices, that's always nice.
But you can advise an artist not to create any weight-bearing structures with POR foam, you know.
Yeah, true.
Like,
or the paper mache only has a battle lifespan of 100 years.
Does it really?
I mean, I say that purely based on anecdotal experience. I can't say that that's actually true. But a lot of things that are made with paper mache about 100 years ago and are fully collapsing under their own weight. So, you know, I'm just thinking that about 100 years, probably about right. So, you know, there is that.
What about all the stuff that my mum insisted on dipping in coffee to stain it?
I don't know what coffee does long term. I like that. That's a
acid, no?
Yeah, acidic. So yeah. Probably going to speed that up a fair whack.
Yeah, but, that's what I'm thinking.
But yeah, it's fascinating to hear what people's process is, you know, like it's fascinating.
I actually have a really cool event next weekend that is sort of related. I'm giving a talk at the Dance Joy, related to the Jewel of Yorkshire dance event, and I'm doing a workshop which is going to have a presentation, obviously, because I'm that absolute dork that is asked to teach a dance workshop and comes along with a PowerPoint.
Amazing.
And I'm giving this presentation on the care of belly dance costumes.
And, I love it.
Of course, they want to know, and they will tell them, how to clean, store, you know, fix, that sort of thing. But what I'm also going to talk to them about is what materials are. I just fleshed out the PowerPoint this morning, so it's fresh in my mind.
Beautiful.
And I'm going to talk to them about foam, and I'm going to talk to them about plastic coatings and the fact that basically everything as a component of dance costumes and dancewear at the moment is just plastic.
Yeah. It's all petrochemicals, baby.
It's all petrochemicals. And if you have all the glass beads, you probably don't want the glass beads because they will shatter and stick in your feet. So,
ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh,
but you don't want, yeah, no, they will last longer, but they will be hella heavy and you'll be bloodstained by the end of your show. Anyway, so that's what I'm doing.
And that's fantastic. I'm glad you're doing that.
Yeah, I'm currently going through how to describe, you know, the care of different types of materials and how to tell what the materials are if people are interested to do that, all of that.
The advice that I've had for cleaning these kind of like performance pieces, I got this from like a YouTube video about how Broadway costumers keep everything clean and don't mm-hmm. have to wash everything every day. They just take a spray bottle, like with a fine mist of vodka.
Wow.
Yeah, I have been mm-hmm. conducting experiments of the last summer. Yeah.
Oh, cool. I'm so curious to know the answer.
Oh my God, amazing.
I mean, I have not been extensively testing as much as I wanted to, because I've not been dancing as much as I thought I would. But I've had a probably about 20-30% of isopropyl alcohol and water sitting next to my dance costumes. And I've started from a new dance costume and after every performance sprayed it till wet with this solution. I don't know if it's worked or not. I don't know. I think maybe you need to have a higher percentage alcohol. But I was trying to imitate the percentage vodka would be. And it might be that they have to spray them, you know, every other day or something.
Does it not just use pure vodka? And do you not want to buy vodka just for this experiment?
Well, no, I didn't really want to buy vodka.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I wanted science. I wanted science. I wanted to know the percentage. I wanted to know what it was that was doing the work. And I thought, okay, well, that's just an oomph percentage in water of alcohol. Spray, spray, spray. See if it works. I think it has slowed it down. And what I wonder is whether, like, consistently spraying keeps the bacterial growth down rather than...
I'm just imagining having one of those aerosol things and just having vodka in it and like just completely fumigating the whole area. Just a costume store right. In wherever they're doing that.
Isn't vodka very starchy? At least I hate vodka because it has like this salty aftertaste, I guess, in my tongue.
This is what I was thinking.
So it does have starch in it, which it...
Would that leave a trace?
Which potentially then would get onto the clothes, yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering about staining.
Surely that's then a food source for other things, potentially.
This is why I wanted to keep it just alcohol, because I wanted to be able to tell the participants in my talk to say,
fair.
okay, yeah, you can do that because it's pretty easy to get. But if you just get some rubbing alcohol as well and mix it 50-50. But anyway, I wanted it to be high percentage alcohol with some water.
Okay, yeah.
To get it all in there. But I have only been spraying after performance and then allowed to dry. I haven't been spraying like every other day or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So it's not a perfect test. It's just interesting. And I think it has had an effect. But I don't know whether it could also have been achieved by freezing the costumes.
I love
that. Or just chucking them in the bath with some non-bio, squidging them about.
Squidging them about.
All right, should we go back to Lost?
Should we talk about Lost? Yeah.
I have one last little question for all of us to answer,
go for it.
If you want. Do you have an object or painting that disintegrated in your hands ever during treatment?
Oh my god.
Or a loss, a big loss of flake?
I mean, flakes, sure.
Anything of the kind?
But maybe not big ones.
We're getting a little taboo with this.
Oh, I love it. It's so spicy.
Conservatives don't like to talk about mistakes.
I know, I love it. I've had people tell me interesting horror stories, like putting things in a bath or something and it completely disappears, right? So I've had stories told to me. I've not witnessed any, thankfully. People always like asking me if I've broken something. And it's like, well, I've broken a part of something, sure. Like something will have come off when I didn't mean for it to come off yet. Or something won't have been like a clean removal and it took a chunk of something with it. You know, like that's definitely happened. 1000%. Saying that now. Show me a conservative that hasn't happened to. But not like a complete breakage. Certainly not a complete disintegration or anything like that. But I've definitely had scary times when something has been much more fragile than I thought it was. I'm thinking of a piece of textile that was probably 3,000 years old, and it had been kept in extremely acidic conditions, and the edges were just powdering when I like tried moving it. Obviously, the main bit of textile, it wasn't actually a big, very huge piece, was still there and fine, but that was definitely damage caused by me. You know, like I caused a loss to that object for certain. Because I didn't realize how incredibly fragile it was because of the acidic conditions. Yeah, so like totally have damaged things for sure. That's definitely a thing, but not like a complete loss or anything like that.
You don't have nightmares about a specific
object? No, I'm quite gentle on myself.
I do.
Oh no, okay.
Yeah, well, no, at the time. So actually a couple of objects in the last 4 years, five, 3 years. Have been highly fragile. So one, separating silk so fragile you think it might be like rice paper.
Ooh,
that kind of so acidic, brown, so fragile. I was wearing all of the optifizers. The only way it was pasted down to a board and the only way I could remove it was to soak the section in water. And wait, and then slide the thinnest tool that I have underneath it. And sometimes it just went through. And there there was no resistance to that at all. But the board was causing it harm and it needed to be removed. And it is now, you know, fully conserved and framed beautifully and it will last. It's just the edges. I was causing damage to the edges because there was nothing else I could do. I feel like I've talked about this particular
you have
trauma. Yeah.
I can't tell you which episode it is, but if you listen to our back catalogue, you'll recognize this.
Consolidated with Venuri.
I think it was our tools episode.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Link in the show notes.
Oh, yeah. Consolidated with the Fenori, which was super interesting because it also allowed me to flush out some of the acidity. Yeah, it was really interesting. But I'm very happy with how it turned out. I have absolutely no bad feelings about any of the damage that I caused because it's now in a much better place. But at the time, I would lie awake thinking about that thing.
Wow.
Like feeling the spatula tool go through the silk, and having that sort of visceral feeling. Really awful. So that's one of my examples. The other one is another object I've talked about on the podcast because it was a big one. The big mine workers banner that I worked on for a year. There were sections of that. So it's the one that came with a big old hole in the middle of it and a bag of pieces.
Oh, lovely.
Those pieces. Oh, God, bliss. those pieces were so fragile. And some of them, they just disappeared because of the state of the silk. It was just, I was, you know, doing my best. And sometimes they would just disintegrate. And basically that told me that that was the way that the silk was going to go. And I a silk crepoline supported it on both sides. And I knew because of what the state of the silk and the fact that the museum wanted to be able to hang it for short periods. I knew that over time, that silk would just disintegrate and you'd have some dust and two sides of some silk crepoline. So what I did was stitch around all of those pieces so that at the very least you'll have, you know, in 100 years, pockets of silk dust in the right places.
Oh, and it will tea bags.
Yeah. But not all of them will go, and not all of them will go at the same time. And encasing them further with stitching was just my way of kind of enclosing the damage and trying to keep it all in the same place, at least that it was intended to be. So yeah, that's my planned loss story, I suppose. And it's a real shame, but you know, when it comes to gigantic objects that are very heavy inherently, and whose sort of significant value and function is in the fact that they will hang or be displayed in some other way or work even, I personally feel you have to accept the loss.
Yeah. I think that that's maybe becoming a more accepted part of conservation as well, is the fact that we deal with loss in our work and that it is unavoidable, much as we may try to fight against it. You know, in our musical instruments episode, Jonathan really emphasized his kind of approach to conservation is largely about balance. And I think that we need to recognize the balance between what we can save and what we can't.
That's beautiful.
It wasn't my words, it was Jonathan.
Yeah, I definitely had nightmares during my Cardiff years. Three nights in a row about one specific object.
Oh, no.
Because it was a very soft, low-fired clay Egyptian object, which was powdering away and poulticing was not working, and mold appeared on it. So I had to give it an ethanol bath. I had to. There was no other solution. And I put it in the ethanol bath on a Friday. And I couldn't access the lab until the next Tuesday because COVID. We didn't have access to the labs as often. And for three nights in a row, I had the same nightmare that I would come back and the ethanol bath would be empty and there would just be mud in the water. The water would be mud, but there would be no object inside. Thankfully, I came back and there was no mud.
That's good.
And the object was fine. But yeah, three nights in a row, I was having the exact same nightmare over.
Yeah. That's a lot.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, I've had those same. I mean, let's face it, they're called intrusive thoughts. And and we all get them. It's that, what if this scalpel was to just slip and pierce the object from top to bottom? Like, we all have those fears.
Oh, and another one during my wall painting days. So flaking happens all the time. And if you're working on your little table, you can pick the flake and put it back where it belongs, right? But if you're conserving wall paintings 5 meters above the ground, if the flake falls, it's gone.
Yeah.
It's lost. And I was doing some original technique mapping and looking at in painting as well and over painting. And at some point, I was in an area that had been heavily conserved, restored back in 2013, so 5 years prior. And a giant flake just fell off. And it was right into the depiction of a man's face.
Oh, no.
And so imagine the center of the man's face is gone.
Oh, no.
It was in infill. So it wasn't original.
But unfortunately, fairly noticeable.
The thing is, the plaster of the original painting was kind of grayish, yellowish white. But this was probably gypsum plaster, the repair. And it was as white as can be. So even when I got down from the scaffolding and I was looking 5 meters up in the air, I could see this white spot.
Oh, no.
And it just looked so white. And to be fair, it's 5 meters above the ground and probably nobody else noticed. Yeah, I will always know that it's there. Just this pure white spot.
Until someone comes in and fixes it.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. So I think about this a lot. Aww. Still.
Does Liz have one?
I have been racking my brain, and I don't have one. I have to say, the materials that I work with in paintings from the 1400s through the late 1700s, those materials are very stable. So in some ways, it is very consistent. And I kind of know what to expect from the pieces. So there aren't a lot of surprises. So I haven't, you know, I've just graduated. I haven't worked on a wide swath yet. So I don't have any horror stories, but I thought maybe I would turn it around and do something uplifting and bring it back to Chloe's starting point about going into the archives and looking for something and finding nothing where there should be something. There's a series of ceiling paintings, I think I've talked about them before, that I've been working on the last year and a half. And the story behind those is exactly the opposite, where the location of the archives for this depot was changing over. And so in the process of moving everything from point A to point B, they found paintings.
Oh, that's nice.
That they had thought were lost. And now they were able to rediscover them and put them back into the collection properly.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Beautiful. That's a nice story to end on. I like that a lot.
Okay, I have one too. Can I do one too?
Yes, yes, do it.
I have no memory of whether I talked about this last season or not. The object that I'm working on at the moment, I won't name the institution, though they're super happy. They'd be super happy. I haven't asked permission. The object that I'm working on is a large, big surprise, trade union banner. And they knew, the museum that I'm working for, knew they had the centerpiece of this banner. And it was in a frame, and they knew where it was, and they knew what the banner was because there's a photo in a book of this banner. But that was it. They just had that central panel. So just imagine a sort of, you know, thin piece of painting on silk. You can't see the edges. You've just got oil paint on both sides, different images in a frame. They didn't know what the other side looked like. And then during typically some roof works and a subsequent leak, they had to evacuate or decant some of their storeroom. And on top of one of the sets of racking, in a massive folded up heap in a box, there was the rest of the banner.
Aww.
Yay! Yes. And so they've given me these two pieces and I am recombining them for the first time in maybe 70 years.
Or wow, more. That's really cool.
It's really cool.
Oh, that's amazing.
You'll ever find.
Gorgeous really nice. Find. Yeah.
And if you've listened to this and if you like what we do, you can become a supporter on Patreon.
you get extra audio content, and sometimes little video bits of content as well, interviews between hosts, and extended content from the episodes.
Thanks for listening. We're The C-Word, and you've been listening to Liz, Chloe, Fedra, and me, Jenny. Join us next time for an episode about glass conservation. In the meantime, you can check out our website at thecword.show or go find us on social media. We're on almost everything. Intro and outro music is Spring by Didi Music, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Additional music and sound effects by Callum Robertson. As always, this has been a Wooden Dice production.